Given how many foods we've been able to tweak or outright reinvent to fit our hurried lives, who would take seriously the Granny Smith, which, not unlike the bayonet or the daguerreotype, is by contemporary standards a cumbersome and unreliable technology? What appeal could an apple have left but nostalgia, the kind of thing you'd find at a Restoration Hardware beside a galvanized watering can? So writes John Mooallem in an investigation into the world of sliced apples in this week's New York Times Magazine, and he joins us today on the politics of food. Welcome, Mr. Mooallem.
Hi.
Well, John, thank you for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
My first question for you, actually, is what would compel a man to write 5,000 words about sliced apples?
Yeah, that's a good question. It was sort of funny because the whole time I was working on this story over the last few months, I almost started to feel like the people at the companies I was writing about, where they would go around and try to sell people the idea of a sliced apple, and people would sort of look at them like they were nuts, as though it were sort of unnecessary. I don't know what compelled me to write about sliced apples. I'd been really interested in food processing in general, especially just sort of looking at how many foods we've changed in the last 10 or 15 years for the sake of convenience. And what I was finding as I sort of looked behind a lot of these foods was that it's never really that easy to do that. There's always these big food science projects that are involved and all these technologies to make foods a little easier to eat that you wouldn't necessarily know about just by looking at the food. And so when I saw the sliced apple, I thought, well, here's a food that looks like very little has been done to it. It's just been cut up and it's some slices in a bag. But I was pretty sure that there must be this sort of saga of what people went through to make it. And more interestingly, maybe, why was that worth it? What is it about us and the way that we eat that made that a practical thing for them to do?
Maybe it's an obvious question, but isn't an apple already a convenience food? It's almost hard to imagine what else we could do.
Yeah, I guess that's the surprising thing about about a lot of technology is that it's doing things we wouldn't necessarily think of as necessary, and then once they're done, they somehow become necessary to our lives. I don't know. The issues with the apples were really there were a few. To say convenience is a bit of a generalization, because even when marketers and researchers talk about convenience, that includes several different aspects of the food. For example, the consistency of the food or the reliability of the food, that it's going to be the same every time. In some studies I saw that was grouped under convenience, and that was a big obstacle for apple growers, especially in the late 90s. Apple growers were finding that consumption basically in the U.S. was flat. We weren't eating, all that many apples in comparison to how many were being grown. And one thing they found was people might pick up an apple thinking that it's going to be crisp and juicy and everything that we want out of our apples, and then they'll get it and it's you know, sort of soft and spongy, and that would turn them off. That would in a sense dissuade them from buying apples again for a certain period of time. So that was an issue. And
well, isn't there a reason for that in the way that we grow and pick and ship apples?
Yeah, well, essentially, there's an apple, like any fruit, it's going to vary from season to season and from fruit to fruit. And then basically the reason we can eat Washington apples, say, year-round is because the apples are all picked in fall, and then they're kept in what's called a controlled atmosphere storage, which is basically just a room that limits, with depleted oxygen in it. And it's from those rooms that the distributors are emptying apples for the rest of the year and getting them to the supermarket so we can buy them. So it's really, as a former head of the Washington Apple Commission told me when I was doing the article, is that it's really, you can't really control what's going to happen to the apple during that whole process of having been picked and then over many months being stored and then being transported to a supermarket, and then maybe the grocer leaves it in the aisle for a few days unrefrigerated. So there's sort of all these variables, and that is not something that really happens as drastically with something like a Twinkie, say, which you know, doesn't sort of demand as much attention or care during the distribution of it.
So now what we feel compelled to do is fit an apple into the Twinkie model.
That's one way of looking at it. Yeah, I don't know that anyone making the apples would necessarily put it that way, but I think there was a sense that if the apple wasn't given some sort of advantage or brought up to the level of convenience or reliability of some other foods, that the business was going to suffer. I don't think, you know, people would just stop eating apples, you know, entirely. but this is, you know, people who are making these sliced apples really look at it as a way to get the food noticed a little bit more and sort of, you know, get more people to eat it.
It makes it competitive.
Absolutely.
In a sense, yeah. You describe in great detail what behind the scenes seems like an iceberg of activity, all of this preparation just to slice and preserve an apple. And the final product is, I don't know, do you think the average fast food eater or the sliced apple eater has any idea of the tremendous amount of work that goes into that?
I would think not. I certainly didn't, just looking at it. I maybe suspected there was a sort of involved process behind it. But basically, the apples, as everyone knows, when you cut an apple, it goes brown, and that was really the big challenge in making these, and I think that in and of itself was a pretty complicated problem to solve. So I think that, no, I don't think people would really recognize, because I don't think people would think about it. I think that's the whole point of these foods, is that they're just there, and they're doing, in effect, what you need them to do.
And once it gets to your table and you take it out of this plastic package and you can easily eat it, it's already bite-sized, you don't have to think about anything. It saves work. That's the idea, right? But as I was reading your description of everything that is involved to prepare these, somewhere along the line, it's a tremendous amount of work. So I kept thinking of physics and the laws of thermodynamics, where energy is always conserved. And so somewhere there are inputs and outputs that we just don't see that are just vast, that I'm curious about.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's probably true for most everything we eat. You know, that's sort of the luxury of and some people, you know, don't like that. Some people resent that we're disconnected from our food in that way. And I certainly understand that. But that is really what a lot of food producers, in any case, view as the luxury of eating in this country, that we don't have to think about it, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, you used the phrase once, cup holder ready, and I think this suggests an interesting relationship of cars to apples.
Yeah, I mean, it was funny before when you said, you know, you get these things at your table and you open up the bag, and in truth, you know, people are eating less and less at tables to begin with.
Right.
But yeah, eating in cars is a really big deal right now, and it's something that for you know, the past several years, product makers have been trying to cater to and trying to take foods that you know, normally wouldn't be really easy to eat in a car and put them in some sort of package that will fit in a cup holder or some sort of version that can be eaten with one hand. That's what they call one-handed food. It's sort of a buzzword. But yeah, there's a statistic in the article from a historian at the Culinary Institute of America named John Nyhoff, and he his research is estimating that about 19% of all meals and snacks eaten in America are eaten in cars.
Hmm.
So that's a pretty shocking statistic, I think.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
But behind that is maybe the assumption that we're hurrying around doing things. But when I'm sitting in my car, I'm not really going that fast.
Right.
So I don't know if it actually works out how we plan.
Yeah. Well, that's another thing, right? That may be one of the best times for us to eat, because we're trapped there.
Right.
Especially if you're in traffic, you don't, you know, need really to keep both hands on the wheel, though maybe I'll get sued for saying that by some automotive association. But yeah, I mean, that's, I think, and I don't know this for certain, but definitely it's my sense in talking to product developers that they understand that, and they understand that that might be, you know, ironically, when we're on the highway, one of the rare times that we're slowed down enough that they sort of have us as a captive audience.
Well, and all of this effort, to some extent, it's for the children, right?
Yeah. It's I mean, that's a big part of it, and that, I think I don't have children, and I think that's a lot of the interviews I did for this article. That would be the first thing people would ask me when I would sort of get on the topic of, you know, well, what is really the advantage of a sliced apple? They would say, "Do you have kids?" As though, and I think it's sort of self-explanatory that we all can sort of imagine a small child trying to duke it out with a giant red delicious apple, and they're not going to get very far.
True.
So I think that you know, many parents are cutting up apples for the kids. They have to if they want them to eat it, and oftentimes it's just easier to throw in a bag of chips or you know, little Oreo bites or something like that.
Modular units.
Exactly. So I think you know, I think that's another thing that these producers saw, especially in school cafeterias, that this was a way to get apples into those spaces, you know, whether it's a school cafeteria or just a kid's mouth,
right.
where ordinarily or otherwise it wouldn't fit.
One of the consequences of this, as you write, is that this bite-sized, easy access, essentially work-free food, it does away with natural limits on consumption. Like an apple, when you get to the end of it, you tend to stop.
Yeah, it does sort of... yeah, giving us something that doesn't imply a portion like that will, I mean, it's only logical that then we won't necessarily know when we're done. You can look at that as a good thing in that, you know, you're free to eat as much as you want, or you can look at that as a bad thing, you know, if you choose to see it as sort of manipulative on the part of the producer. I tried to sort of shy away from those, you know, ascribing any sort of motive on that. But it's definitely a consequence of it, sure.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems almost like we're approaching the end of non-bite-sized food. And maybe the beginning of pellets.
Yeah.
We just have dispensers in our cars, and
right.
We press the lever.
Well, that's I wrote in another article I did about processed foods, I brought up the fact that the futurists, which were these sort of zany artists and politicos in Italy, they imagined that one day we would just have food broadcast into our bodies over the radio.
Broadcast food, I like it.
Yeah, so there is definitely, you know, there is something definitely futuristic about, we tend to always imagine a future in which eating is takes up less and less time for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
And it does in certain ways look like we're going that way.
So there's no longer any middleman at all. We're just connected by tubes.
Yeah.
We don't even have to like reach that. For it.
Something like that. I mean, who knows what's going to happen? I think it's, you know, it is interesting to see that as foods are getting more and more convenient and eating is getting some, you know, less and less demanding on us, that it's, we're also seeing things like slow food, and there are always backlashes to these things.
Mm-hmm.
So it's tough to say, you know, how far it's going to go in any one direction, but it's definitely really cool to see it happen. It's interesting to watch.
Do you think about whole apples differently now that you have been inside some of these production centers?
I don't know. Yeah, definitely. I think I've never really thought about these issues. I mean, I think I had a sense that I personally prefer to eat an apple sliced up, I guess. I don't, I never thought that I would need to buy it that way necessarily. But I do recognize that there is, you know, for whatever reason, it's just somehow a little easier to eat it in pieces.
Mm-hmm.
Or for me, at least a little more pleasurable. But yeah, I mean, I think that's something most people can relate about. And that was something I was really trying to put my finger on and really couldn't in the end is what is it that makes that easier?
What I was also curious about is, that this production of apples also saves us from something else. And you suggest that it's our own disgust. Talk a little bit about that.
Sure. There was, well, in trying to figure that out, why it was more desirable to eat a sliced up apple. One thing I kept hearing from all different people was, well, you know, then when you're done with the apple, you have this core, and the core's, sort of wet and gross. And I kept thinking, well, why is it that we would rather hold a wet plastic bag at the end of the snack than the core?
Mm-hmm.
So I called this psychologist at the University of Pennsylvania named Paul Rozin, who's an expert on disgust, essentially. And he's really a brilliant guy and has written some really interesting essays and papers about the way we eat. And he sort of told me right away, well, the core, it's sort of, I think he says it's an extension of your mouth. And your tongue, and it's got you all over it. It's got, your spit all over it. And that is apparently repulsive.
Mm.
We're repulsed by our own spit, which I think that's definitely true.
As we try to be more and more hygienic.
Right. I think as we get, I don't know that he would argue that disgust is a major turnoff to eating an apple, but I think it definitely does play a role, especially as we get more and more used to eating, the processed foods that seem a little sleeker or drier, let's say,
mm-hmm.
And that just seem a little less, have a little less nature in them, let's say.
Yeah.
That something like an apple starts to seem a little more crude, especially after we've gnawed into it.
Well, there's evidence. There's your teeth marks, and it's kind of sticky. And
right, yeah. And if you think about eating an apple, each time you're taking another bite, you sort of have to, put your mouth back on this chewed up thing. Whereas if you're just eating slices, each one's its own shape and each one's clean and it hasn't been touched yet. And it's sort of a new experience every time.
And it's, I suppose, easier and less complicated to share.
Yeah, I think that's a big part of it too. Yeah, you wouldn't necessarily want to pass an apple around, although I've definitely done that before.
I have too, but it's interesting what happens. It immediately clarifies your relationship with that person.
Yeah, absolutely.
How close am I? How well do I know you?
Right, absolutely.
Do they bite from the other side?
Right. Right, it's sort of, and even just, I know being at a movie with a friend or something and then reaching into the same bag of popcorn can sometimes be too intimate of an experience for some people, so you can imagine what biting into the same apple is like. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, there is that life and sort of uncontrolled wildness, things going off and it's turning brown, and you did a wonderful job describing exactly how that works in an apple specifically. And you use, in a few places, you use the language of battle. As if these our industrial processes are waging war against the natural processes that are taking place in the apple.
Right. Well, I mean, in a certain sense, they are, right? They're trying to keep the apple from growing brown. And the apple is going to go brown. That's what it's going to do when you cut it. So in that sense, the sort of objective is pretty clear cut, and the apple is going to do everything it can to brown, because by browning, what I learned was that the reason the apple browns is because it's trying to essentially kill a layer of itself so that it won't be open to contamination.
Mm-hmm. It's so, a defensive layer.
Right, exactly. So that brown layer becomes almost like the new skin of the cut apple. And so that's what, that's what the apple's sort of doing, in a sense, to survive without, kind of anthropomorphizing the apple too much. And these companies have to keep it from doing that. So
is that also an extension of the ripening process itself? Do I understand that right?
That the browning?
Well, the same physiological processes in the apple, in the cell, that make it ripen, is that part of what's happening?
It's actually slightly different. The ripening, it does sort of accelerate its ripening, from what I understand, when it's cut.
Mm-hmm.
But the browning itself is basically because when you cut open the apple, you're sort of busting open all the, these cell walls with the knife itself. And so you mm-hmm. have all of these different enzymes and things in the apple that are normally kept separate, which are now intermixing. And those reactions between those things is what's going to give you the brown stuff.
Mm-hmm. And they have a very sophisticated process for stopping this.
Right. What happened was they you know, people had been trying to do this for somewhere around 20 years,
mm-hmm.
Because they knew that making a cut up apple would be a great boon for the industry. And what, you know, people had come up with other solutions in the past to try to stave off the browning, and what finally worked, and what, as I understand it, most producers are using now is something called Nature Seal,
mm-hmm.
Which is made by a company in Connecticut, which makes things like coatings for candy and time-release coatings for pills and things like that. And I think most people will know that if you just sort of pour lemon juice over an apple, that will keep it from going brown for at least extend the amount of time. And Nature Seal works in somewhat of the same way. It's all natural, the company says, and it's largely just vitamin C and calcium.
Mm-hmm.
And what it's doing is just sort of interrupting the reaction between those enzymes that I mentioned before.
Mm-hmm.
And works in pretty much the same way lemon juice does, but it's made so that you can do it, in a factory, and will keep apples from going brown for, they say, 21 days is what they tell you, and you know, I've seen them stay looking fresh for far longer than that. So.
Yeah, it seems to work spectacularly well.
Yeah, yeah.
So we're almost completely away from a live object.
Well, that's one way to look at it. Or the other way to look at it is that we're you know, essentially prolonging the life of the apple,
mm-hmm.
indefinitely, because that's
right.
I mean, it is almost like a kind of life support for the apple once it's wounded, right?
Right.
That's
true. We should compensate the apple in some way.
Right. Okay. Fair enough.
You also write, John Mualim, when you talk about people choosing apples in a supermarket, if at some point they got an apple that they didn't like, they wouldn't buy apples again. And we were talking about this earlier. No one, after all, you write, walks down the chip and cracker aisle squeezing bags of Fritos to see which one is best. And this forms a question in my mind, which is, if we don't have to decide if an apple is ripe, is this making us a little more dumb?
Is it making us a little more dumb? Perhaps. I think it's definitely, I think that there's definitely that vision of the technological future where everyone is just sort of force-fed or food's broadcast into your body and
right.
it's all sort of done for you. I think that there is an essence of that here. And I think maybe the more interesting question is, do people care if they get to pick their apples, or
right.
picking apples something that we just sort of rather leave to the experts?
Or is it a trade, at least? A
trade-off
where we choose one kind of intelligence for another?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely am, you know, I like food. I definitely sort of lean the other way. But I guess if someone's willing to pay for this, even though that might be surprising to me, I can still appreciate, that it's a value of theirs, that this is important to them and it's worth the extra price, or it's worth giving up that choice.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the way a lot of things are going in the supermarket, I guess, is to sort of direct you to get what you want with the least amount of hassle.
Mm-hmm. John Mualim, we're wrapping up here, and I want to know what your favorite apple is.
My favorite apple?
Mm-hmm.
I had and I'm going to forget the name of it, but I just had an apple the other day called something like a Kentucky Black or something like that, and I'd never seen one of these before, and I might have just...
Oh, I think I've had one of
you know
those.
This? Yeah,
yeah,
it's really like almost blood red black
color. And it's bright,
color.
Bright white inside,
yeah.
Like snow.
Yeah, and that was a good apple.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
Did you eat it whole?
I did eat it whole. I did eat it, but I ate it while walking.
Were you okay? Were you okay? Did you break a sweat?
No, I did break a sweat, but that was probably from the walk. I was going uphill, actually. So.